First Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse was released in theaters last month to critical acclaim and success at the box office. It featured a unique mixture of 2D and 3D elements. It's a departure from the Disney Pixar style we've seen dominate animation over the last two decades. More blockbuster movies like Puss in Boots, The Last Wish, and the upcoming Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie are following a similar path. How does this new style build on animation of the past? How have artists innovated the medium up until now? Our next guest is a Wisconsin expert on animation history, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite animated movie or TV show? What makes it special or memorable? What animated movie or movie with animation elements blew your mind when it first came out? Is there a style you prefer? Do you like to watch animation from outside the U.S., like, say, Japanese animation? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies is an associate professor and director of film studies at UW-Milwaukee. Jocelyn, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob. I always love to be on.
Good to have you back. Now, we've had animation pretty much for as long as we've had movies, right?
That's definitely true. As a matter of fact, it's kind of hard to separate animation from live action. They're both sort of based on the same principle, right? Which is that there's 24 frames per second. With animation, those frames are just drawn or sometimes, you know, performed by stop motion. But yeah, basically since the beginning of film, we have the emergence of animation as a form as early as the very, very early years of the 20th century.
What were a couple, give us a taste of the couple of earliest types of animation we saw?
Sure. There's two that we generally point to as kind of like hallmarks of sort of first film, first animated films. It's always a bit like difficult to say with certainty what is the first. But generally speaking, historians agree that John Stuart Blackton's The Humorous Phases of Funny Faces from 1906 is the first animated film. When you see it, you can look it up on YouTube. It's pretty widely available. When you see it, it'll look almost like it's hand-drawn, but it's actually done with cutouts. So that's the first kind of animated film. But then Emile Cole's Fantasmagorie from 1908, which is really delightful, kind of like surrealist metamorphosis little film. That's really the first drawn animation, the first cartoon that we think of. And that is in 1908.
All right. One name tends to dominate, I think, what we think of when we think of animation. And one movie really set the stage for traditionally animated feature films. Here's a taste.
I hope, I hope, I hope, I hope.
It's Snow White. It's Disney. Can you talk about this as a milestone for better and for worse?
We cannot talk about animation without talking about Disney. And there's a way that I want us to kind of think about him today. And that's not necessarily as an artistic innovator, but as an absolutely incredible businessman. If I were to, you know, to categorize Walt Disney as one thing, it would be shrewd businessman, because he was very, very good at hiring the right people and occasionally getting people to, well, maybe kind of steal other people's work. So if we're thinking about something like Snow White, there's several really incredible technological developments that are present in that film. The first one is the multi-plane camera. And this is one of the most important developments for animation in general, especially if we're thinking about eventual transition over to digital animation and to 3D environments. The way that the multi-plane camera worked is that it was about a 15, 20 foot tall structure, this really tall structure, and it had multiple panes of glass, right, stacked on top of each other with a little bit of space in between. And each glass pane had a different piece of artwork that would constitute one of the different layers of an environment. And then the top pane, you could have the cell animation of the character moving. The camera would then shoot through the top of the top pane through all of these different layers. And that gives this really wonderful feeling of three-dimensionality in what is actually a 2D work. So the next time you look at Snow White, especially these sequences in the forest, you should notice how the layers kind of seem to move, and you get this kind of uncanny illusion of moving through deep space. That's achieved with the multiplane camera. And the funny thing about the multiplane camera is that even though William Garrity patents this in 1937 under the aegis of Walt Disney, Something very, very similar was actually made in the 1920s by a German animator named Lottie Renninger. She made this really famous feature called The Adventures of Prince Ahmed in 1926. And she developed this this object called the Tricktisch, or the trick table. And that was an early iteration of the multiplane camera. But the thing is, she never patented it. So Walt Disney was able to take that one over.
Now, I want to talk about the labor that goes into something like a Disney-style feature film or the other people who imitated or inspired by it. Could you just talk about the labor and who was doing all this work?
Yeah, when we think about animation, we should always be thinking about labor. We think about a movie set in general, and like there's so many people involved. It's easy to say like, oh, there's the set designer, you know, there's the cinematographer, there's the best boy and the gaffer. But there's just as many people working in an animated film. It's just that their labor is invisible because we don't end up really seeing them on screen, and we only see the eventual art that results from their work. Early on in animation, early animated films, they're primarily made by one person, right? Like one artist does everything from the writing to the designing to the drawing, everything. But that's really inefficient. That takes a lot of time. It's super, super labor intensive. So once animation becomes something that's picked up by bigger studios, the studios start thinking, well, we could actually make this a much more efficient practice. So in the 1910s, cell animation is developed, and that's where you have the cell of the character animation on top of an already animated background environment, so you don't have to redo that background every time. But the other thing that's determined by studios, as well as people like Winsor McCay, who are working on animation and creating these great innovations at this time, they realize that what we can do is we can do something called in-betweening using keyframes. And a keyframe is going to be like the major movements of a character. So think of a character like jumping in the air and landing. The keyframes could be the character preparing to jump, the top of the jump, and then the bottom of the jump. But in between, there's a whole array of like very minuscule, tiny movements that the character is making. So you can have your head animator do those keyframes, right? And establish those big movements that require a lot more expertise and a lot more artistry. And then you can have other folks come in and do the what is called the in-betweening. And those were positions, the in-betweeners or the colorists or like the line colorists. Those are positions usually taken on by people who might be apprentices, who might be learning the trade, and actually often by women. So these are really, you know, really important roles, but they're performed by people who are generally like below the line folks. As we move forward in the history of animation, that kind of labor becomes a real sticking point, right? How do people get paid for the work that they're doing, the really important work that they're doing? That's why in 1941, we see the Walt Disney animation strike, which was a really big thing that rocked the industry and important to think about today when we're actually going through the SAG-AFTRA strike as well.
Looking at the history of animation with Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies from UW-Milwaukee, let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Chris is with us in Delavan. Chris, hi.
Hi, how's it going? I just wanted to make a comment that you know, the animation style that Across the Spider-Verse did and its predecessor, I thought was really positive to the industry. And that's one of the main reasons why people really love it. And, you know, especially since, you know, anime is becoming so popular and mainstream nowadays. And what's really funny, you know, because we brought up Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and how this next movie that's coming out is going to be kind of following that same animation style. I was talking to my fiance the other week, and I said, wouldn't it be great if Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles would do something like this? Because I feel like that's what they need, because all this realistic, you know, animation that they've been doing the last, you know, 20 years, I don't think works for them. It's a little creepy, and I just think that would be great. And then lo and behold, I saw an article, and that's, sure enough, that's what they're doing. And I think
wonderful. Thanks a lot for the call, Chris. And Jocelyn, Chris gives us a lot there. We've had this Disney Pixar, well, Pixar then bought by Disney style, the 3D animation, and these reactions to it now with the Spider-Man movie, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie on the way.
Totally. I mean, I think like the obsession with this particular version of digital realism is so annoying. It's so reductive, right? It doesn't leave space for some of the wonderful things that animation can do. Animation is a mode of like boundless possibility, right? It's the space where absolutely anything can happen. And I think we've gotten really stuck in this mode of mimicking reality as opposed to embracing the wonderful stylization, the wonderful artistry, all these like absolutely incredible possibilities that have always been latent in animation. So if you watch something like Fleischer Brothers cartoons from the early 1930s, the Fleischer Brothers are some of my favorite animators, just like really amazing. If you watch them now, they will seem like completely bizarre, completely weird, because it was a moment of total experimentation. So I think with this obsession with being really, in some ways, you know, quote unquote, true to real life, we've forgotten about all of the boundless possibilities that animation actually grants us. So I agree. I'm just really excited to see a new level of artistry brought back into animation.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Jocelyn Sopaniak-Gillies, Associate Professor and Director of Film Studies at UW-Milwaukee, looking at animation and how it's changed over more than a century now. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite animated movie or TV show? How have you seen animation change over maybe your lifestyle? Is there a favorite style, a favorite producer, director of animation? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Jocelyn Sopaniak-Gillies, Associate Professor and Director of Film Studies at UW-Milwaukee. We're looking at the history of animation from the dawn of moving pictures through the Spider-Man multiverse and beyond. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have an all-time favorite animated TV show or movie? What do you see as really groundbreaking? Do you have a favorite style, old school or newfangled? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Back to your calls. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, you got a favorite?
I do, yeah. Thanks, Rob. Ever since I was a kid, I've always liked Donald Duck. And the reason is he has emotions. And when I was a kid, I always watched him express his emotions. And he always came to a point of laughter. So years later, I was on a cruise and I bought a lithograph of Donald Duck laughing. And in my apartment, I put the lithograph as the last thing I would see when I left my apartment. And he always made my day, because his laughter and his smile, I mean, the emotions were real to me and pointed the right direction of how I wanted to feel. And it was more than just entertainment to me. It was really kind of a psychological affection I had for him.
Interesting, Jeff. Thanks a lot for that. And Jocelyn, Jeff points toward the connection we could feel with these clearly non-real characters from, you know, a Donald Duck through maybe a Pixar character or beyond.
Absolutely. And, you know, Jeff is like actually absolutely right. He has this feeling, but what he's also noticing is something that was deliberately put in there by Disney. Disney animators were trained in the 1930s in a form of animating action that is extremely expressive. So they were actually trained by folks who came from the acting world as to how to integrate movements that specifically spoke to emotional expression. That was something that Disney animators deliberately developed over time, and it was particularly studied right when Snow White was being made. And Snow White's also made with the use of the rotoscope, a really important animation technology where an actor is shot live action, and then the animator traces on top of that actor. So that translates to a real fluidity of movement. It actually is kind of like an uncanny movement a little bit, but it's very fluid, very naturalistic. And then the animators would later use that footage to study movement and then to integrate that kind of expressive movement into characters, specifically to create an emotional connection with the audience.
Thanks a lot for the call, Jeff. I want to back up. We talked about kind of the post-Pixar era. I want to talk about the movie that kicked off Pixar being the thing.
You're my favorite deputy.
You got a friend in me.
And here, Jocelyn, a lot of people had a friend in Buzz Lightyear and the others in Toy Story. Now we're so used to the style. How big a deal was it when Toy Story came out?
It was such a huge deal. Sorry,
there's an air show going on behind you, I understand. Yeah.
Yeah, the air show is happening back there. It was such a massive deal. So Toy Story comes out in 95, and there's already a lot of experimentation with digital animation at that point, but Toy Story is the first fully digitally animated feature. So it was just like a massive deal. If we look back at it now, it's actually kind of creepy. Like, the characters don't blink. It's very creepy if you look at it now. But it really was massively groundbreaking. And Pixar itself has just been such a juggernaut in terms of animation. Once Disney finally acquires Pixar in 2006, well, they had tried to do it for quite a long time, but they finally do acquire them in 2006. And that really leads to Disney being like such a massive global multimedia conglomerate that really directs how we understand childhood to a great extent.
Let's go back to our callers. Jack is with us now in Madison. Jack, hi.
Hi, Rob. Hey, so I heard your guest talking about Toy Story just a moment ago, and I should say that I was born the year it came out, incidentally, so I've always had a thing for CGI, but I guess to combine that with, you know, talk about Snow White and the other old animated pics, got me thinking about a game that came out a couple years ago called Cuphead. Mm-hmm. You might have heard of it, and I think it's really cool the way those game devs were able to fuse a lot of the digital and CGI tech that we have today with nostalgia for old animation. And I know, just it's cool thinking about how and when the older mediums meet the newer ones and what implications those have for future games and movies.
Jack, a great point. And not just Cuphead, but I think a lot of video games play with different animation styles. And I've read, at least, Jocelyn, that the Spider-Verse movies are then looking to video games as inspiration as well. There's this conversation going on.
Oh my gosh, you can't see me clapping, but I am like so excited that Cuphead was brought up. Let me be frank, Rob. I can't play video games like Mario jumps, he falls in the hole. Mario jumps, like that's my video games experience. But I have a special love in my heart for Cuphead because it's based on Max and Dave Fleischer's cartoons from the early 1930s. They were famous for a style that we call rubber animation. And that's where, you know, you'll see in Cuphead that like the characters kind of like stretch and shrink and they bounce off things. And they have this very kind of like bouncy, springy kind of a way to them. That is directly inspired by the Fleischers. And the Fleischers worked a lot with urban life. They were New York animators. They were Jewish. They were around a lot of immigrant communities. They went to the Cotton Club and they loved Cab Calloway. So there was a lot about like the urban multi-ethnic depression experience in their films. And then we see that in Cuphead now. It looks so uncanny to us because it's actually from an earlier moment in history. And history is something that gets very deeply uncanny for all of us. But video games in general, so important for animation. I think about something like Final Fantasy from 2001, which was a massive box office failure, but was actually directed by the creator of the game. So that's like an early moment where we see this transition from video games into animated feature and vice versa. They're kind of always playing into each other in multiple ways.
Jack, thanks a lot for the call. Jocelyn, I don't want to get out of this conversation about animation without a visit to Japan. Anime, the catch-all term for a huge variety of animation coming out of Japan. What are some of the distinctive styles we see in animation from Japan?
Yeah, there's so many that to point to, but I think we think a lot about something like Astro Boy, right? Like from the 1960s, which actually, it's really, really funny, is based in part on the Walt Disney style. So that's actually based on something like Bambi, the really big eyes. So a lot of like what we think of as originating from Japanese animation also is inspired by cultural product from the United States. So those really big eyes, especially from these earlier moments of Japanese animation, are in large part inspired by Disney characters. One of the things that's really important for Japanese animation too is the usage of limited animation. And, you know, I should try to like keep this as short as possible, but limited animation is essentially animating fewer than 12 frames per second. And that gives it that kind of stilled quality, right? Like where a character might be screaming and they're frozen. That's very, very much a hallmark of Japanese animation. But also just really elaborate environments, right? Like really fast movement, fast kind of camera movement as opposed to character movement. Japanese animation is a really, really rich, incredible legacy of powerful artistry and really, really big ideas.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Jocelyn, is there something you are excited about on the horizons of animation?
Well, my favorite contemporary story is, or contemporary studio, pardon me, is Laika Studios, who are responsible for Coraline, for Paranorman, for Kubo and the Two Strings. I'm looking forward to their newest film because they integrate wonderful artistry, beautiful stop motion animation that's very detailed and very stylized with some usage of digital smoothing. So you still have that wonderful feel of the hand of the artist that's combined with the forefront of digital technologies. And I love that they use so many human beings to make what they make. Right now, especially, it's so essential for us to remember that art is created by human beings and not by machines.
Jocelyn, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
It's so wonderful to be on. It's great to talk to you, Rob.
That's Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies, Associate Professor and Director of Film Studies at UW-Milwaukee. She talked to us about the history of animation and how the techniques of the past influence the animated movies and TV shows of today. Hey, there is still time for you to share your favorite animated movies and TV shows, or maybe a character from the world of animation from anywhere in the world. Tell us about it over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. If I get a couple few responses on that, I'll share them maybe tomorrow or next week.